versus the retired pilots. Ms. Sicati.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Babette Sicati for the Airline Pilots Association. This is an appeal of an order of District Judge Lefkoe terminating the United Airlines Pilot Defined Benefit Plan under the involuntary termination provisions of ERISA 29 U.S.C. Section 1342 and setting as a date of termination December 30th, 2004. ALPA appeals the order because the Court's order established December 30th, 2004 as the effective date of termination. And ALPA seeks a later termination date, a date that is consistent with the termination date contemplated by ALPA's agreement with United Airlines, a termination date that is also consistent with the settlement agreement reached between United Airlines and the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. Because the PBGC initiated the termination...
That's all you're asking?
We are seeking a later termination date, Your Honor, yes.
That's all?
Correct.
And how much money is involved in that request of yours?
Trial court determined that the additional amount would be $84.2 million in additional liability. Because the sole ground on which the PBGC moved to terminate the pilot plan
was... That's just for the 1 month?
No, Your Honor, that would be... The date representative of a January termination date would be...
How many months?
6 months, Your Honor.
6 months.
Because the standard that PBGC cited was the unreasonable increase standard, meaning that the unreasonable increase to the fund, to the PBGC, of a date beyond December 30th, a determination that $84 million constitutes an unreasonable increase within the meaning of Section 1342 is tantamount to a finding that the termination date is December 30th, and conversely, if we convince you that that number is not an unreasonable increase, it means that the plan cannot be terminated as of December 30th, 2004. In addition, ALPA has challenged the application as a matter of law of the notice cases that were applied both by the bankruptcy court and adopted as modified by the district court in determining that the PBGC's constructive notice as a matter of law extinguished the reasonable expectation of the pilots in the continued accrual of their benefits.
What prejudice did you suffer from that lack of notice?
Your Honor, the prejudice in setting the date as of
December. Talking about the notice.
The notice, the prejudice that was suffered by the union is that in its efforts to communicate both its reaction to, its negative and adverse reaction to the precipitous action taken by the PBGC, the courts ruled that this was tantamount to providing notice that...
I don't understand you. What is the prejudice that you suffer by this form of notice?
The prejudice in the form of notice, Your Honor, is that the content of the notice told the pilot group that ALPA was opposed
to this...
What's
the prejudice? What's the harm?
The harm is that by...
Something tangible.
By treating the notice as effectively extinguishing the pilot's expectation and continued accrual of the benefits, if the case law is applied as a matter of law, then the pilots are stuck with it.
You're not listening to my question. My question is, ordinarily, if a person is complaining about lack of notice, the complaint is because I didn't get the notice, I did something, which I wouldn't have done otherwise. I lost money, right? I was hurt.
Your Honor, the notice...
How is your client hurt?
The client is hurt because the courts have said that the construct...
An answer the courts have said is not an answer to the question, what is the hurt? X million dollars lost because you were surprised, you didn't have notice.
The pilots lost the benefit of the increase in the guaranteed benefit that would have taken effect on January 1st.
If you don't get notice of something, you know, you're surprised, so you do something different from what you would have done. What did they do differently as a result of not getting notice earlier?
The question suppose notice had been given in 1982, right, that the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation wanted to terminate the plan at the end of December 30, 2004. What did you lose relative to earlier notice, but with the same termination date specified?
continued accrual of the benefits in effect because the court takes the notice as tantamount to the date of termination under the notice cases.
That's what's lost by the termination date, not by the notice date.
It is tantamount to the same thing under the case law, Your Honor.
All right. No, all right. That's a better move on to something else. That's
certainly
hopeless.
Your Honor, the court, in ruling that the context of the $84 million, my time has expired, Your Honor.
Well, we'll give you, well, why don't you finish your thought anyway?
Thank you, Your Honor. The court ignored the effect of the settlement, the PBGC settlement with United, in which PBGC proactively was able to protect its interest in assuming responsibility and liability for all four of United's defined benefit pension plans. The PBGC settlement set, in effect, the latest possible date for that and backstopped the amount of its liability. It reserved the right to seek the preferred date of December 30th, 2004, but in effect, because the settlement contemplated that the pilot plan could terminate as late as June 30th.
All right, I'm lost. Now, is the issue you're arguing now whether the $84 million would represent an unreasonable increase in the PBGC's liabilities? Is that what we're talking
about?
That's
exactly right, Your Honor. And yes, that's exactly right.
So why? What do you think should be the standard for an unreasonable increase? Should it be a percentage or what?
The standard should be whether the amount is monetarily significant in the context of the PBGC's overall recovery and the overall recovery in this case. In this case,
I understand. There are $84 million in the hole, right?
They were able to secure from United Airlines an agreement for an allowed amount of the full amount of their termination liability, in addition to additional consideration not provided.
Are they $84 million in the hole or not? I mean, have they lost $84 million? Is that
the negotiation of the recovery under the settlement, Your Honor, contemplated the risk?
That's my question.
It would depend upon.
Do they owe? You know, they have another $84 million in liability.
Your Honor,
Yes or no?
It depends upon how the settlement recovery that they received was internally processed by the PBGC to account for that risk. It is that they assume the risk of a later date in negotiating a settlement up front.
I don't understand you. I don't know what you're talking about.
Your Honor, the settlement provided for a sum certain to the PBGC, which assumed the prospect of a six-month swing in the termination date. They assumed the risk that the date would not be December 30th, but would in fact be June 30th.
I'm not asking whether they assume the risk. I'm asking whether they have lost any money.
Your Honor, they may have lost money, but within the...
They may have lost. What's the uncertainty? Is it $84 million or is it 10 cents?
You aren't saying that the district court's $84 million finding is clearly erroneous, are you? PBGC said it was losing more than that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Excuse me?
PBGC said it would lose more than that. The district court found $84 million. I don't understand
Correct.
Your brief to say that that's clearly erroneous.
No, no.
So we have to assume that that's the PBGC's net loss, do we not?
We can assume that that's the net loss, but the relevant question is whether under the statute it is an unreasonable loss as a matter of law, and our position is where they negotiate a return. Where they negotiate a return that specifically includes the possibility that a termination date could be 6 months later than the date that they seek, it is not unreasonable within the meaning of the statute.
So it wouldn't matter if it was $84 million or $840 million?
Your Honor, I think it would matter if it was $840 million. Here, the PBGC assumed liability for 6.6.
Why does it matter? Why would $840 million matter, but $84 million wouldn't matter?
One would assume that in that sense, the settlement would not have been as it came out. In fact, the pilot plan might not even have been included if the pilot plan was in that such a horrendous shape as to cost the PBGC that much more relative to the amount it was able to secure from United. This amount, $84 million, is 1% of the total liability they agreed and negotiated a return for in the context of the PBGC settlement. Therefore, as a matter of law, the amount cannot be considered unreasonable. That's our position.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll hear from. We'll give you a moment later, Mr. Carrillo.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I'm Jack Carrillo. I represent the retired pilots. Our approach is different from ALPA's. We believe that this termination order should be reversed. that the PBGC did not prove their case at trial. I would just ask the court for a moment to focus on the impact of this decision on the retired pilots, both in the context of this bankruptcy and the PBGC case. They've lost their life insurance benefits. Their medical insurance benefits were reduced. The United, despite a bankruptcy court order to the contrary, stopped their non-qualified benefit payments, which are not insured or covered by the PBGC. And then this appeal...
But that's all irrelevant, right?
Well, that will be the subject, Your Honor, of the second appeal that we'll argue to you in a moment.
It's irrelevant to this case.
This focuses on
PBGC insured benefits.
Sure. This focuses on the qualified pension benefits. My point, Your Honor, is that when you take that...
Well, forget that and just focus on this issue, would you?
Sure. They needed to prove that there must be a termination to avoid an unreasonable increase in the liability of the PBGC's fund. A must termination, sir.
You have that backwards. The question is $84 million such a large loss that they have to terminate the insurance in order to avert it?
Well, Your Honor, there's no $84 million loss. Let's start with that.
Well, that's back to Judge Easterbrook's question.
Well,
what is the loss to PBGC?
They have no loss.
They have no loss.
They have no loss, Your Honor. The $84 million was their potential liability if United could not afford the plan, if the plan assets were not sufficient. Our actuary, and we put in this evidence at trial, the portion of the pension plan that was earmarked for the retired pilots was funded to 105%. PBGC did not bring this complaint claiming that the minimum funding requirements of PBGC were not met. They brought it under the unreasonable increase in the liability of the fund. And what I believe that necessitates, Your Honor, is that for there to be an unreasonable increase, they have to show that the sponsor of the plan, in this case United, could not afford the plan. Congress looked, when they put this statute together, as to whether the language of the statute should be any further increase or any unreasonable increase in the liability of the fund. Clearly, if a sponsor can afford a pension plan...
Are you saying PBGC is not going to lose $84
million? No, I am saying that, Your Honor. I am saying that. The
How
assets,
are they going to avert that?
Pardon me?
How are they going to avert that?
The way to have averted it...
They're not have averted. How are they going to avert it? How are they going to save their $84 million?
They will save their $84 million and not lose anything by simply applying the plan assets that are in place that were already contributed to that fund and paying the retired pilots what they deserve to be paid. They won't lose anything.
I now don't understand this. The reason you're appealing is because you want more money from the PBGC. Money doesn't grow on trees. Where is the extra money coming from?
The money, Your Honor, is already in the plan assets that pay out these benefits.
I don't think you're getting the point of the question. There is obviously a money difference between what happens if the plan terminates as of the end of 2004 and in the middle of 2005. That's why you're appealing, right? And the money is going to come from the PBGC.
The PBGC, Your Honor,
aren't these propositions just self-evidently true?
The PBGC has assumed the plan assets. There are sufficient assets there to pay the retired pilots. And if the assets are sufficient to do that, they will lose nothing.
Look, PBGC at the moment is the residual claimant on the fund. I can understand the argument that although the date difference will mean $84 million extra for the beneficiaries of the plan, that doesn't count because it's adequately funded. But I don't understand the argument that it won't cost the PBGC anything, because that implies that your clients don't get anything, and then I don't understand why you're appealing.
We're appealing the termination of the plan. There are sufficient assets within that plan, Your Honor, to pay what should be paid.
So your argument boils down to the claim that the plan is 100% funded.
On a going concern basis, Your Honor, it is. But my argument is more than that, Judge.
My argument is more than that.
My argument is they can't.
This is Nelson Rockefeller again.
Well, I don't think so, Judge.
Pay as you go, and we'll not worry about capital assets or anything like that.
Well, if the statute requires them to prove an unreasonable increase in the liability, not just that there may be a further increase. There are plenty of healthy companies that don't have plans that are 100% funded, yet they can't terminate those unless they can show that the company cannot afford the plan. And there was no evidence of that presented at this trial. And there should have been. And we produced the evidence from the PBGC's own expert that demonstrated that their proposition was false, that this plan could be afforded. American Airlines received financing and has a defined benefit plan. And the PBGC's expert compared that and showed that United's credit metrics that they said were necessary to afford this plan were too strenuous. So they did not conform to the statute, Your Honor. I would like to save some of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor, unless you have a question.
Well, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Seligman?
May it please the Court, David Seligman on behalf of United Airlines. Your Honor, United Airlines, although a defendant in the pilot plan termination proceeding, are not contesting the termination of the plan. In fact, at the time that the termination proceeding was brought, we were in the process of commencing our own voluntary termination proceeding. The point that the arguments that we're making here today are twofold. One, we believe that the appeal of the retired pilots should not be considered dismissed or rejected because of the fact that the plan of reorganization and the business, which relied on a business plan that did not have payment of all the pension plans here, has been substantially consummated.
Would be the consequence of what would be? Well, there are two issues. One is whether your creditors and so on, exit creditors, had notice of this litigation and their terms were, you know, designed to protect them against this risk. Second question is just what the magnitude of the effect would be, whether this would trigger, you know, defaults or anything of that sort. I didn't see anything of that in your brief.
In our brief we talked about how if this plan required minimum funding contributions between the 2005 and 2010 period for this plan only of over $1 billion of cash. And that's not cash that we had, and that's why we believe that termination of all our pension plans were required. So if this court were to
you're answering my question. What would be the actual consequences if they, if either the
consequences for the people who put in the new capital? So far as I can see, the only consequence if we reverse is that the U.S. Treasury kicks in $84 million. It doesn't look like there is any effect on the third-party investors. And if there's no effect on the third-party investors, who obviously don't perceive any because they're not protesting, why would confirmation of the plan matter?
If this court were only deciding the issue of the termination date, that's not
the only issue we can decide. To the extent the retirees are complaining about our decision earlier this year that the termination agreement is valid, that's water under the bridge.
Then you were correct. The retirees
can complain about that all they want, but that's already been decided.
If Your Honor's question is what's the harm if you chose a later date to United, there would be no harm to United.
It's not to United. It's to the third-party investors who put up money for the plan. That's the concern about disturbing reorganization plans.
Well, if this court chose a different date issue, it would mean additional liability for PBGC, but I'm acknowledging that it's not.
The only person whose monetary interests are on the stake are on the one hand the U.S. Treasury and on the other hand the pilots. The third-party investors are indifferent, which surely is why they're not here.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm just here to make the point that if this court were to reverse the termination in its entirety, that would put the plan back to United Airlines and require United to have billions of dollars of additional cash contributions over the next couple of years, which would render our whole restructuring, which would put us back to the drawing board in terms of our restructuring. So that's the only point I'm here. If this court is not going to revisit the underlying issue of termination as opposed to the termination date, then that's not my issue. I just want to make sure that the plan is that nobody reverses the termination, puts the pilot plan back to us, gives United a whole host of additional funding contributions, because it would knock the props out of it from our whole restructuring, because it wasn't just creditors who relied on
creditors and all the rest. They knew about this litigation, right? They knew it was unresolved.
That's correct. They knew that, but again, there was no stay pending appeal. There's always risk in any Chapter 11 case that any appeals
This is the law of litigation. It's not just prospective litigation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And people did have notice of it, but again, I believe that people have notice of lots of pieces of litigation going on a case, regardless of whether they're big or small. But at some point, somebody has to rely on a confirmation order being entered, the company exiting from bankruptcy. This company obtained $3 billion of exit financing from the capital markets. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of creditors loaned money to this, allowed their claims to be discharged, received stock under this plan, and third-party investors on the capital markets have bought stock, as we said in our brief, hundreds of millions of dollars of shares of stock. They've bought notes and they sold notes, all upon reliance upon this business plan of this company embodied in the plan of reorganization that did not contemplate paying.
So your real argument is that the bankruptcy would have the reorganization would have failed if the various third parties had not been able to rely on the fact that the retired pilots hadn't asked for a stay. Is that what it comes down to?
Exactly. We would have to go back to the drawing board, and all the other employee groups in this case, they all made concessions to this company based upon proportional and shared sacrifice by all the other parties. So again, it's not just a question of exit lender loaning money based upon a business plan and cash flows, but it's also other investors, other employee groups who made concessions based upon proportional sacrifices, and we would have to revisit all those things.
Okay.
The second point that I'd like to talk about, Your Honor, is the PBGC's cross appeal. They are appealing Judge Lefkoe's order to the.
It's not really a cross appeal.
You're correct in the sense they could have just raised it as appellee. Our only concern, Your Honor, is their argument that this whole pilot plan termination proceeding should be thrown out, and we should have to start over because of the fact that Judge Lefkoe at one point referred the matter down to Judge Weedoff as a related to proceeding. And our point there is number one, because PBGC got everything they asked for in this appeal, their appeal on that particular issue shouldn't stand. They're certainly free to argue that there should have been a different standard of deference, but as far as arguing that this whole thing should be thrown out when they won, I think that should be rejected. The second point is that there's actually no harm here. What the PBGC is claiming their harm was.
It's not clear to me, actually, why the pilots aren't embracing the PBGC's decision. If the PBGC wants the decision in its favor thrown out, we can just send it back to the bankruptcy court, back to the district court for the addition of the $84 million.
Again, if it's just a question of the $84 million, that's we don't have an issue with that. Our concern is that the whole termination gets thrown out. If it's just the $84 million, we have no problem with that. But we'd say that PBGC got what it's bargained for. It wanted a ruling by the district court. It got by the district court.
I understand, but it's hard to take seriously the PBGC's argument for deference when its legal position on this appeal is so absurd.
Well, then I guess with that, I don't have anything more to say on that point, Your Honor.
Okay.
And based on that, we respectfully request that the order of the district court be affirmed. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Cohen, here you come up against a good lead in there. Sure it's encouraged you.
Jeffrey Cohen on behalf of PBGC. May it please the court. While this case does raise issues that go to the heart of the PBGC's business, which is its ability to mitigate losses.
Why do you talk about a cross appeal? You don't want anything different from the judgment of the don't like the standards you
apply. The judgment but not the opinion.
Right.
Your Honor,
one keeps saying, we say in a zillion cases, no, a cross appeal is just to change the relief that was ordered. It's not to quarrel with what the district judge said.
Your Honor, it's a tricky issue. We looked carefully at the...
No, it's not tricky. It's a slam dunk.
Well,
I think
your position is absurd.
The problem with not having appealed, from our perspective, was that none of the three courts below, two district courts and the bankruptcy court, none of them looked at our administrative record, as far as we can tell.
You can argue that all you want.
Well, that is part a huge part of our problem, even though we prevailed on
the
merits.
This is a subject that we have said this before, as Judge Posner said. The Supreme Court of the United States has said this multiple times. What you want us to disregard, repeated unanimous decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States. An agency that wants a court of appeals to do that is not litigating with its head screwed on right.
Well, Your Honor...
And it's also pointless. You can ask us, you are asking us, to say that Judge Lefkoe applied the wrong standard.
Deference.
Well, we can say that, and
That is one of the things that we take issue with, and the other was the referral to the bankruptcy court in the first instance.
Well, we can say that, too. We can say that was a mistake, but...
Well, if the court feels that it can make that finding an affirmance...
Well, I don't understand you. If you read our cases, you would know that. You wouldn't be under any doubt.
Your Honor, I think that had we not cross-appealed, our opponents would have said that we waived the issues.
Couldn't say that, honestly.
I suspect they would have.
They can say anything, but they'd be wrong if they said such a thing.
I would think so, Your Honor, especially to the extent that we're talking about... what is the right standard of review?
But
since
you did appeal, what they can say correctly is that you were in the wrong.
And apparently, on this panel, they would carry the day.
On any panel of any court,
Your Honor, if I could turn to the substance of those issues, however, on the referral, the Congress made very clear in ERISA that that the district court is the appropriate place to bring an action under Section 1342. It is, and notwithstanding the pendency of a bankruptcy in that court or in any other forum. And the reason for that is because it's a regulatory action undertaken by the government. It is not to adjust the debtor-creditor relationship, although PBGC is certainly a creditor of United and takes no issue with having to resolve its claim, the amount of its claim in that forum. The involuntary termination action should have been heard by the district court and Article III judge. That error was then compounded when Judge Weedoff held that there was no deference to be given to PBGC's administrative determination to terminate the pension plan, but instead reviewed it on a de novo basis. And it made it a much more difficult litigation than it needed to be.
Was the PBGC's decision to file this lawsuit made after either adjudication or notice and comment rulemaking?
Not the latter, Your Honor, but the former. It was
made after adjudication?
An informal adjudication. It's precisely the sort of adjudication that was reviewed by the Supreme Court in the LTV case. And it is not a trial-type hearing. It's not that kind of adjudication, but the statute calls for a determination to be made by the agency in both in Section 1342 or in 1347.
Is it public?
No, Your Honor, it's not public.
Well,
suppose the Sherman Act calls for the head of the antitrust division to make an informed determination whether to file a lawsuit under the Sherman Act. The head of the antitrust division makes such a determination and files a lawsuit. What respect do the courts owe to the decision to file a lawsuit?
Your Honor, in that instance, is my limited understanding of the antitrust law is that's clearly an action where the government would have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that there was collusion or some other illegality.
And why is this any different? The statute says that the PBGC has to make a decision, and then once the decision is made, it's a decision to file a lawsuit, and it's then resolved in court.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's quite like that. There are actually two determinations. One under 1342A. That we're going to face the risk of unreasonable loss, and then two under C, yes, it does require a request for
But the question is the procedure. So take this parallel. So the National Labor Relations Board, there's a similarity here because its orders are not self-executing. If it wants an order enforced, it has to come to the court. And that's similar here. And yet we give deference to its findings. On the other hand, before it comes to the court, it has a administrative proceeding, adjudication, on the record, you know, adversary process, internal administrative appeal. So when it comes to the court, you know, we can say that yes, they it's supported by substantial evidence. But what would we look at in the here? There doesn't seem to be a record that we can look at of your internal decision that this was unreasonable.
There is a record, Your Honor. It is a part of this record as a result of the record on appeal. It was before Judge Dara.
So what is the procedure then that creates an internal record?
There is a recommendation by the staff working on a matter that goes before what's called the trusteeship working group, which is an interdisciplinary body within the agency, which considers the analysis and information presented to them.
But there's no adversary process.
There's no adversary process, Your Honor, but it is exactly like the process that was reviewed by the Supreme Court in the LTV restoration case in 1990. And all of the courts on the way up found problems with that informal adjudication, and the Supreme Court did not find a problem with it. They said that was perfectly appropriate under the Administrative Procedure Act and was to be accorded deference, particularly since it was within the agency's area of expertise. Likewise, this case, and I think that goes to the question Judge Easterbrook asked before, why is this different than the Justice Department or the FTC bringing an antitrust case? This is within our area of expertise. It's a discretionary act,
but we need
the court to enforce that.
I think, counsel, that one would say that the head of the antitrust division has some expertise about the antitrust laws, has discretion to decide whether to file suit, and if so, when. Have you given any thought, by the way, to Adams Fruit Company against Barrett? I noticed that none of the party's briefs discusses Adams Fruit.
No, Your Honor, to be candid, I have not.
It's a holding by the Supreme Court that when Congress authorizes an agency to enforce its statute by filing suit, the decision to file suit does not get any deference.
I see that my time has expired.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. So, Ms. Saccotti, we'll give you a couple of minutes while your time expired. So.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the deference issue, we agree with the district court's decision based on the wording of the statute that 1342 sets up a two-step process that requires an adjudication by the court. Because the statute, ERISA also provides for...
Certainly would have helped if somebody in this large group of high-priced lawyers had paid some attention to Adams Fruit, which, so far as I can tell, is the Supreme Court's major case.
I believe the counsel for ERP is indicating that they had it in their brief, Your Honor. With respect to the notion that the panel might consider reviewing the administrative record or some notion based on the administrative record, it should be pointed out the administrative record never got to any sort of consideration by the bankruptcy court. It would have to be supplemented. It represents a position that the PBGC changed in the settlement, so the notion that this could be now accomplished with the same termination date, if they wanted to start all over again with a different termination date, then I would agree with Your Honor that we would embrace that decision. But they are looking to have a record that really cannot be reviewed now based on the progress of the litigation, the conduct of the trial, and the change in the PBGC's position. So the notion that the case could start all over again or reach the same result on the administrative record, we think, would be an error. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Saccotti. Mr. Cariglio, want a couple of minutes?
Actually, Your Honor, not to duplicate anything that Ms. Sicati just said, and just to turn for a moment to United's comments about whether they could afford the plan going forward or whether there would be an impact on third parties. They've argued this point in the abstract before, and what Your Honor mentioned in your last opinion on this United Airlines case was that the court can always remand to the district court if there is a reversal to deny any relief that would jeopardize United's newly recovered solvency. So if they really have a third party who's impacted, or if United can make a case that, unlike American Airlines, they can't afford this plan going forward, they can put on a witness who can be cross-examined and prove it. And that's all we're asking. I don't think they can, and they haven't up till now. If the panel has any further questions, I'd be glad to answer. Otherwise, I thank you.
Okay, well, thank you to all counsel.